Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's program featuring our panel speaking on the topic of manufacturing consent, the failure of EU elections, media, and the public sphere. My name is Daniel Vorwerk. I am one of the board members for ICFRC, and I will be your host for today's program. We are deeply grateful for the longstanding support from our community, many of who are here with us today. Your help has allowed our organization to grow for the past 40 years, and hosting speaker programs with experts joining us in person and online from across the world. As a small nonprofit, we exist because of the generosity of individuals like you. We would also like to extend our heartfelt thanks to those joining us virtually or watching the program broadcast online or on City Channel 4. You are an integral part of our broad, interconnected community. I hope all of you will consider making a financial contribution today by scanning one of our QR codes on the tables or visiting our website. These free programs are only possible because of the support that we receive from our community. And finally, thank you to our sponsors and community partners for their support. In particular, today, we recognize the Iowa City Public Library for their partnership and for the refreshments served today. And a big thanks to the UI Political Science Department for sponsoring this program and supporting ICFRC's Democracy Series. Our other series are excited about this incredible, important seven-part series. The first six will precede the November elections, and the final program will be 2 weeks after. So check out more information, including our full list of amazing sponsors, on the posters at your table and on our website, icfrc.org. And so before I get to introducing our speaker today, I am going to turn it over to Peter, our executive director. Peter.
Yeah, thank you very much, Daniel. So one of the things that we have been doing for this democracy series is inviting up a couple of Iowans to talk about their own views about democracy. I'll first refer you to the posters at your tables. On one side, you'll see information about the seven-part series, those that Daniel just described. We will have a couple more coming up, three more, two before the election, one right before, and then one 2 weeks after. On the other side of that poster, you'll see some voting resources. We are very keen to encourage people to get out, to be informed, to be knowledgeable about where, when, and how to vote. So please do check those out, as well as how to get registered to vote. So what we have been doing for this democracy series is inviting two individuals up. So I'm going to ask my friends Pratibha and Jason to come join me up here. And we asked them two questions. The first, what does democracy mean to you? And the second, why is it important in today's world? So I'm going to turn it over to Jason first for his thoughts on those two questions.
All right. Thank you, Peter. Good afternoon, everyone. So when Peter asked me to speak today, now the first thing that you think about with democracy is certainly like politics and government, right? A system that is voted by the people, for the people, with certain rights and liberties. And for the government to protect those liberties, without a doubt, involving a free press and such. But you know, when I think beyond government and politics, you know, you think about just the word like democratize, and that just to me is just simply giving all people access, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be through representation. It could be access to jobs. It could be access to recreation. It could be access to healthcare. So you want to democratize certain systems and certain pillars of our community. So, you know, I think democracy can go beyond just the government politics, and it just, you know, it does play a role in our community as well. Why is democracy important today? Was the second one. I think you hear it a lot because, you know, a lot of people, and we do see some evidence, or at least I'll speak for myself and seeing some evidence, that it's at risk. And I think people will start to have a lot less confidence in some of these systems and in some of these policies, and people will leave. You know, I'm someone who has lived and worked a fair amount of my life abroad. My wife is an immigrant. We don't have to be here, but we choose to be here. But if we feel that our rights and our democracy is declining, you know, that can be a serious economic issue of people even wanting to be here. Not that, you know, I'm saying we're going to jump ship, but, you know, when you have options, you need to look at those options pretty closely. And, you know, the weakening of a democracy would undoubtedly, you know, can play a role in that.
That was so eloquently spoken. Hello, everyone. When you asked me what democracy means, it's my fifth grade education coming into play, and it's just people's government. And I think something that Jason touched on, it's such a privilege to have the option to vote and, like, have the say in your government. And it's not just this broad scale, like, countrywide. It's also in the municipal level, just going out and voting. It's not just every 4 years, but it's every year you have a chance for your voice to be heard. If there's an issue in your community, a lot of the chances is voting can help fix that.
Great. Thank you both very much. Give them a hand, folks. So again, please do register to vote. Please do be informed about who our candidates are. And please, please do vote either before or on November 5th. Daniel, back to you.
Perfect. All right, so now I would like to introduce you all to our speaker today. Peter Gross is a professor emeritus and former director of the University of Tennessee's School of Journalism and Electronic Media. Before his tenure at UT, he held the Gaylord Family Endowed Chair at the University of Oklahoma, Gaylord College of Journalism and Mass Communication. His research focus is East and Central Europe society, media, and journalism. Peter.
Well, given the introduction to this whole program, the question about democracy, I think I could make my presentation and then be here for another 5 hours to discuss all of it, but we'll skip that. The topic of my presentation today has to do with the EU parliamentary elections that played out this summer, an interesting kind of election for a number of different reasons. I have put up on the screen how things worked out. You've heard much about the right making a great deal of progress and therefore endangering democracy in the EU. They did make progress, but not quite that much. Certainly not as much as people have argued they did. The left made progress as well, by the way. They gained some seats. And so the middle is still holding. I have put up on the screen the various party groupings so you understand what we're talking about when we look at who gained how many seats and what the implications might be. I think the most interesting grouping is the one on the far right. I don't mean politically, just geographically there. The non-aligned or non-attached members who range from the Communist Party of Greece to the very, very far-right SOS party in Romania. I don't know how that grouping was formed. I don't know why it is placed on the right. It should be somewhere in outer space, but there it is. And it I suppose, has a bit of play, but not that much. I think it's pretty much dismissible. So I want to talk about five different lessons or truisms that have emerged from this 2024 elections. And the first one is that the European elections remain still predominantly national elections with all the implications that are attached to that. Secondly, these 2024 elections demonstrated again the variance between North and South European countries, East and West, regional differences, and none more accentuated than the difference between what might be called Western Europe and East and Central Europe, and to a much lesser extent, the Baltics. Three, what has long been called the EU democratic deficit has not been eliminated. That is the separation between the European public, which, by the way, is still in the making. We talk about a European public, but that's not solidified in any way, and EU institutions. Four, interest in EU matters has grown over the years, but voting in the 2024 elections remained far below the 61.99% that we experienced in Europe in 1979, the highest turnout to date. And just for a little bit of background, the Council of Europe was formed in 1949. It turned into a co-legislative branch with the European Parliament Assembly, which was established in 1958, which subsequently changed its name to the European Parliament in 1962. All of this is a bit confusing because the European Union was not established until 1993. So try to keep track of all of that, and let me see if I can manage this high technology here. I guess I can. Okay. How do you advance this? This doesn't work. Okay, we'll work with this. All right.
The forward arrow button here?
Okay, I thought that was sideways. Can you see that? All right. So in 2019, turnout was 50.66%. In 2024, 50.74%. Not much of a turnout when you think about it. Okay, the fifth lesson. To create a European public, Europe really needs a pan-European public sphere and a pan-European media that would aliment it with all of those necessities that make a public sphere function, that is, debate and discussions on certain topics together. Number six, the last lesson, I suppose. Absence, the viable existence of a public sphere and a public media. What will remain unachieved is what Walter Lippmann has positively described during the 1920s as the comprehensive and reliable manufacture of consent, a rather efficacious and requisite outcome not only for democracy, but in defense of democracy. Lippmann's description of the difficulties humans have in understanding the world appears generally not to have changed. Arguably, it has even increased in our contemporary world, given that, as he put it in the 1920s, and I quote here, the real environment is altogether too big, too complex, and too fleeting for direct acquaintance. So here is where I stop, and I want to talk more about the public sphere and the media. For democracy to function, it needs a space for rational public discourse and debate. There's just no doubt about that. It needs what Hannah Arendt writes, that such a space represents the common world that gathers us together and yet prevents our falling over each other. The conceptions of a public sphere are apropos not solely to a democratic society, but in larger terms to a democratic EU that has long been accused, as I have already pointed out, of a democratic deficit. Progress in creating a pan-European public sphere has been nebulous, selective, ill-defined, and difficult to express. Claims by some scholars that there is a deteriorized public sphere, in other words, it's not all territorial, where the traditional separation between foreign and domestic and global and national have ceased to be pertinent, are far too optimistic. In fact, this view is not supported by the reality of the 2024 EU elections. the differences that I pointed out between north and south, east and west, and so forth. That said, some common threads or themes were certainly present in this last in the summer, suggesting to some that there is at least a making of a public sphere that gave birth to or sustained these commonalities. A post-election survey by Eurobarometer shows the following reasons why Europeans voted. Ah, I managed it this time. I'm getting so technologically savvy. As you can see, the turnout, 11 out of 27 countries are above the 50%. Four only, and the rest only 50%. Turnout is really, really low. And that itself signals to some degree that the public sphere is not there, that people are not engaging with it. What this graph doesn't show is that these issues were not embraced in every country, nor were subject to an equal level of mediated communication and public discussions, and certainly were certainly ranked differently in importance by EU member countries. This is important to remember because this not only speaks to the public sphere, but it speaks to European democracy and European identity. Overall, according to the Eurobarometer data, what heightened interest in the 2024 election, first and foremost, was a focus on defense policy, tightly linked to overarching geopolitical tensions, which is quite understandable given the Ukrainian war in Russia, given what's happening in the Middle East, and given what's happening in other parts of the world. It is undeniable that in restricted, irregular, and qualified ways, a level of transnationalizations of the national public spheres that began in 2019 continued through 2024. By transnationalization, I mean the flow and exchanges that take place across national borders. This is exhibited by the network sphere of data flows that is structured around the thematic threads and engages a fluid, however relatively small, community of like-minded peers who are concerned citizens of diverse societies and come together to deliberate on issues both of national and global relevance. Thus, we can assert that to some extent, public spheres are expressions of or intersections of the echo chambers that are created by the media, and most specifically by the social media and in digital spaces. This restricts the degree of transnational actions aimed at opinion formation and EU lawmaking, which remain less than institutionalized, and as such, it also inhibits the creation of a cohesive pan-European public spheres. Scholars agree that first and foremost, a true continental public sphere necessitates, one, a common language, two, a shared identity, and three, most importantly perhaps, a common structure, which in this case is meant, by this is meant a pan-European media. It is evident that neither of these vital elements are seen as fully present or likely to develop in the EU within the near future. Additionally, nationalism, identity politics, and social media and information disorder, by that I mean content that is misleading, misinformation or false or fake, disinformation, are impactful elements diminishing the present possibility of a true continent-wide public sphere. In this atmosphere, the increased polarization of EU integration meant to heighten public awareness and interest in EU politics with the aim of reinforcing the connection between the EU and its citizens is having a yet-to-be-addressed negative outcome, namely It restrains national leaders from compromising to solve pressing policy problems for fear of domestic backlash, chiefly because Eurosceptic actors and political parties are intent on rallying national publics against the EU and additional integration. Their success, so it is said, threatens an increase in Euroscepticism in EU institutions, impeding the EU decision-making process, and in the worst case, as some argue, even threatening the EU itself. I have a different take on this issue. If close attention is paid today to today's Eurosceptics, they advocate for the decentralization of power, greater EU accountability, particularly in finance, in financial matters, and efficiency, respect for sovereign rights of member states, and some other things that I will not go on mentioning. In short, with some very extreme exceptions, their programs correspond to European values, obviously, because they are already a result of a compromise between the various national parties united into one party group or another in the EU Parliament, as you have seen. The second reason why Euroscepticism has generally become toothless is institutionality. Having gone through the European election procedure, it entered Parliament and became involved in the institutional game. The Eurosceptics have been forced to soften their rhetoric, so they have become a systemic opposition rather than an alternative to the EU. So back to the public sphere. There are arguments for expanding the overlaps between national public spheres and increasing their interconnectedness. This too is a bit quixotic, an exceedingly demanding proposition, even in the digital age, given language and cultural barriers, and in some cases, the unconsolidated national sphere of the member countries of the EU. And yet another option that continues to be encouraged is the Europeanization of national spheres, principally by increasing the visibility of EU actors, EU institutions, EU policies, EU issues, and thus closing the gap between EU citizens and the leadership of the EU. This Europeanization is intrinsically tied to what and why national media cover the EU. It has only been marginally successful. It battles difficulties that range from some national media reporting regularly or almost regularly, albeit selectively, on plenary debates on EU issues, to parliamentary actors playing a minor role in national journalism. The EU Parliament is on the losing side for media attention in its competition with national parliaments in the EU, in EU news, compared to executive domestic actors. Furthermore, setting aside EU elections, EU activities in which national parliaments are engaged appear to be of greater interest for the media than those of the EU Parliament, not least because journalists still seem to find it difficult to cover a parliament that is so different from the national parliaments that readers are familiar with. Absent a pan-European public sphere, Europeanizing the national public spheres of member countries that is argued is connected to one another appears to be theoretically an achievable goal, one that has certainly not been fully achieved. There are a few mutual concerns that European societies could build on to Europeanize their national public spheres, as expressed in the data mentioned earlier on why Europeans vote in the elections. Is that page 4? Yes. Oops, sorry. So, in a post-election survey done by Eurobarometer, this month, fresh off the presses. You can see the rising prices and cost of living were the concerns of 42% of voters, the economic situation 41%, the international situation 34%, democracy and the rule of law 32%, migration and asylum, the environment and climate change, the EU defense and security 28% each. This does not seem to be an overwhelming focus on common issues. Equally so, it may be a basis for establishing a phased approach to set up mini regional and transnational public spheres built around regions, obviously. Northern Europe, Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, the Baltic states, and so forth. They could have a unified information communication approach that speaks in several voices and could manufacture consent on EU issue and politics. So this is not very encouraging, but it is a start. So these mini regional public spheres could be established via bilateral or trilateral or even quadrilateral agreements, like the 2024 Moldova-Romania-Ukraine agreement to collaborate on creating what is essentially a public sphere focused on Russian disinformation, and the earlier Weimar Triangle that was signed in 1991 between France, Germany, and Poland, forming a regional alliance to support cooperation between the three countries in cross-border and European issues. Some of these mini regional public spheres could be built around small neighborhoods, as I mentioned, mutuality of language, Austria and Germany, Czechia and Slovakia, Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and North Macedonia, for example, or those with common borders. I'm thinking here of Germany, Denmark, and the Netherlands, for example, or Poland, Ukraine, and the Baltic states. Once established, of course, their interconnectedness should be vigorously pursued. None of these possibilities of creating one or multiple spaces for rational public discourse and debate can be achieved without a complementary media system. More specifically, a media system that aids the rational public discourse by providing factual, contextual, balanced information delivered in a fair manner. That most certainly necessitates an orientation towards fact-based, non-ideological media that does not create multiple echo chambers and eliminates the rational from discourse and debate. Establishing media that are trusted and are thus capable of manufacturing the required consent for a democratic EU and in defense of it is crucial. By 2023, trust in the news has fallen across Europe, in many countries erasing some gains that were made during the coronavirus pandemic. Across the EU space, an average of 40% say they trust most news media most of the time, really a minority. Finland remains the only country with high levels of overall trust, 65%, followed by Denmark, 57%. And here is a breakdown of trust in media by countries. Eastern Europe lags behind altogether. Southern Europe is only slightly better, with one exception there. Western Europe is slightly better, but nothing to write home about. So we have a trust deficit in the media in Europe that is not a minor one and definitely affects the kind of public sphere that we're talking about. A staggering 74% of Europeans believe that misinformation is a national problem. 86% say disinformation is a problem. and 71% say they often come across this information. This is a frightening kind of data that even if it's softened by some other considerations, speaks volume to the essence of Europeans talking to each other in the public sphere on the basis of information they don't trust. Television dominates as primary news source for citizens, about 71%, followed at a distance by online press and news platforms, 42%. Radio and social media platforms share the third position with 37% each, but social media is making are making a great deal of progress throughout Europe. Not equal progress, but progress nevertheless. The much heralded globalization of media that new technologies has facilitated is contributing to a relatively greater public awareness on several issues. Now, when we talk about globalization of media, we're talking about internet-based and social media outlets. John Keane, a British academic of some renown, rightly contends, and I'm quoting here, that global media conglomerates create products for imaginary global audiences. Simultaneously, they suppose and nurture what he calls a theatrum mundi, whose audiences witness mediated controversies. And among those controversies, as I've listed on this World Theater bill, are issues like climate change, immigration, economic issues, and so forth. The internet and social media, which, as I said, constitutes the global media, that are disseminating information and are facilitators of traditional media's global exposure, help individuals in what remains a nebulous global society to become, as Keane says, a bit less parochial and a bit more cosmopolitan. True to some extent, the effect of global media depends on the size of their audiences and is generally qualified and subject to ever-changing terms depending on the issues, the problems, and matters related to the audience's own societies, personal daily concerns, and so forth. The outcome of the EU parliamentary elections, particularly in East Central Europe and the Baltic states, and along with their national media's general coverage in Western parts of Europe and Western part of Europe, supports this conclusion. But I would argue that the evidence offered by the outcome of the 2024 EU elections implies that citizens in these regions are concurrently both a bit parochial and a bit cosmopolitan, and not one or the other having any ascendancy. EU citizens more or less share a gamut of values, often tied to their geographic area, historical, cultural, political, and or ideological interpretations. These include freedom, democracy, and other enlightenment principles, as well as the fears related to economic, political, and security issues associated with European conflicts, migrants, global competitions, Russia, China, and so on. Yet the structure of news and public opinion formation that is arrayed against these fears and expectations and on behalf of the workings of the EU and its institutions is first and foremost the loosely stitched patchquilt of national outlets, media outlets. These outlets are themselves politically atomized in almost every country, perhaps best at serving a bygone era in global existential context. But the reality is that national media will not soon become relics of the past. A pan-European media that would facilitate a unified response to any issue are missing. The reach of the few outlets considered pan-European or quasi-pan-European remain restricted to the EU elites. Some academics, politicians, government and state officials, and so forth. I'm thinking here of Euronews, which is headquartered in France, Politico, headquartered in the US, EU Observer News, which is headquartered in Belgium, what's called a local headquartered in Sweden, Transitions in Czechia, Balkan Insight in Serbia, and Euroactive in Belgium. There might also be an argument that national outlets that publish or broadcast in a number of languages, English being the most common, could be considered quasi-pan-European, assuming that it can be shown that they heftily Europeanize their contents and that they have a large audience. I'm thinking here of Le Monde, Deutsche Welle, Gazeta Wyborcza in Poland, Radio Sweden, what's called ERR News in Estonia, and a handful of others. In the absence of a true pan-European media, paralleling the earlier mentioned suggestions for Europeanization of national public spheres, the Europeanization of national media across EU member countries is having a modicum of success, even if uneven from country to country. This has both positive and negative outcomes, by the way. During the last decade, EU actors, politics, policies, institutions have become far more salient to the national media. But this is mainly due to a multiplicity of crises or polycrises, that is the casual entanglements of crises in multiple global systems. But whether the project of Europeanization will organically or by design go beyond the level that it has reached is impossible to prognosticate. While not discouraging the further Europeanization of national media, I propose the establishment of regional hybrid media, something along the regional public spheres I spoke about earlier. Granted, this does not alleviate the cultural, organizational, or linguistic problems, and to one degree or another, dissimilar journalistic practices that makes the creation of a pan-media serving 27 countries less than practical. 27 countries, okay? Keep that in mind. Regarding journalism, let's remember that the level of journalistic practices, their independence, their ethics, the laws that that rule them, so to speak, are not shared throughout Europe, even though European institutions keep insisting that they should. Lastly, several pan-regional media would at least pare down the linguistic demands of disseminating in 26 languages a pan-European media. I say 26 because obviously Austria, Germany, they speak the same language, right? So we don't need 27, we need 26. It would pare it down, a pan-regional media would pare it down to one of 11 languages. In Eastern Europe, at least, until other countries there join, or three languages in the Baltics. I mean, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania are not the same, but there are some similarities, and as they keep telling me in these words, unfortunately, we also share one other language, Russian. So there it is. The unresolved conundrum is how to reconcile the online and social media preferences of these audiences and their effects. And I'll give you one example. Regarding Russia's invasion of Ukraine, research findings point to those who trust mainstream or traditional media being considerably more likely to align themselves with EU and NATO interest. Those who trust the traditional media. Think about that. We know that the greater trust people have in mainstream media and perceive them to be independent, which is another discussion, by the way, the more likely they are to believe that Russia invaded Ukraine and to support Ukraine, Ukraine's NATO and or EU membership. On the other hand, digital communication is a catalyst for the transformation of public communication in all societies. But here we are with traditional media being trusted, mainstream media being trusted more on an issue like this. This recognition that social media, media's effect on establishing echo chambers have a high potential of resulting in or adding to political polarization could be turned into a positive by focusing on the these echo chamber on their echo chamber aspects to manufacture consent on EU issues, actors, policies, and institutions. It's a two-way street. Care must be taken to guard against hybrid regional media foundering on the shoals of national and or institutional hubris and national politics that may wittingly or unwittingly creep into their work. This is a concern that flags issues of identity and the ability to establish a pan-European public spheres. Despite their ascent, there are several reasons why social media alone do not rise to the challenge of serving European audiences. One reason is the continued sharp digital divide. With access to the internet and to social media widespread, being uneven from one country to the other. In addition, there's an acute urban-rural divide and in the skills that accentuate the digital divides. Certain groups of privileged citizens have unfettered access while others have been left behind, and this issue must be resolved. The European Broadcast Union survey suggests that across the EU countries, 54% of respondents have the required level of digital literacy. That's slightly above half, not a very good number. 74% of Europeans believe, as I said, misinformation is a problem, and so forth. And this is a problem that hinges on resolving the issue of a shared media system. And by shared, you can define that any which way you want to, but it has to be shared to bring information and news on these issues. Given that we're at the dawn of mass artificial intelligence, solid digital skills are essential to help Europeans separate fact from fiction. And as I said, they're not there. As described, variations of pan-regional European media have a theoretical chance to better prepare their audiences to resist disinformation and enhance the efforts now being made by supranational organizations, NGOs, and even states. They have a theoretical chance to cover the EU, its institutions, actors, and policies in a more concerted and focused way than the attempted Europeanization of national media has been able to do. And perhaps the most pregnant possibility is that such media can garner trust in regions where there is a general absence of trust in national media, as we've seen. So it is not the future of a united Europe that depends on all of these changes and additions and things we've talked about, but rather its nature, strength, and success. Europe is trying very hard, has been for a very, very long time, to create a true union. So far, it's eluded Europe with some minor successes, but the project is incomplete, and the longer it goes incompleted, the more Euroskeptics will push against it and perhaps turn away from being part of Europe and truly being against it. The rise of right-wing parties in Europe, particularly the example of Hungary, which is part of the EU, garnering around itself all sorts of like-minded political parties and people is a danger. But I want to remind you that there is at least one grouping in the European Parliament on the left that is also Euroskeptic in nature. So we have a lot of work to do in Europe. I sort of have one foot on this continent and one foot on the other continent, being born on that other continent, and intensely interested in what happens in Europe. So thank you for listening, and I'll entertain whatever questions that you may have.
All right, so if you have any questions for Peter, go ahead and raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone over to you.
Things affecting different elections within the different countries of the EU. So, like, is it a big issue that they discuss in their campaigns or not? What's going on with the EU or what should happen?
It differs from country to country. EU elections are very important, as you've seen, by the turnout in some countries are not very important in other countries. National parties, when they debate issues, particularly in Eastern Europe, they are not so very much concerned about the EU at all. They love being in the EU and they love being in NATO, basically as a way of trying to protect themselves against Russia. More than anything, they fear that side of the world, if you will, given the history that goes not only back to the communist period, but before that as well. So that's the EU is a conversation piece that is far more limited than in some what we call Western European, what should be called Western European countries. And the importance of a conversation about the EU mostly hinges on the ambitions of particular politicians who want to be elected to the EU Parliament, because it really is a very cozy life in Brussels.
Hi, thank you for your thoughts. Traveling in Europe recently, talking to people, it was clear that there was good Russian mispropaganda, blaming the US for the Ukrainian war rather than blaming Russia, saying that it was, you know, Americans wanting to sell arms. It was that kind of focus. Is it common, or were we talking to the wrong people?
It's not that common. And if I'm going to divide Europe between East and West, I would say it's far more common in the West than in the eastern part of Europe.
It was Austria, Hungary, and Czech Republic.
Yeah. Czech Republic surprises me, actually. Hungary does not surprise me, because Russian disinformation and misinformation is encouraged by the Orban government. I'm not so surprised about Austria. It's a Western mentality, and that doesn't surprise me. Czechia does surprise me to some extent. The blaming of the U.S. For all of this runs along the same lines that I talked about before, and that one example, at least, is the notion that Russia had to invade Ukraine because NATO was going to expand eastward. NATO was never going to do that. That was not in the books. And the irony is that what Russia tried to prevent NATO's expansion by marching into Ukraine had the opposite effect. And now we have Sweden as a member of NATO, and a couple of others that will soon join. Yes. So it had the opposite effect. It was false to begin with. Anyway, misinformation and disinformation seems to be a global phenomenon that needs to be combated. It's here in the U.S. It's everywhere else. And it's doing a lot of damage. I mean, we started this program by talking about democracy. I am confident when I say that probably the most salient problem or threat to democracy is misinformation and disinformation, because everything starts there. Secondarily is the creation of echo chambers, which encourages the kind of political polarization, and even worse, the ideological polarization that ultimately hurts democracy. Because once polarized, we don't talk to each other. I mean, look at the Republicans think about Democrats as the worst things ever, and the Democrats think about Republicans as the worst things ever. Friendships are ended, families are split. I mean, my God. And a lot of it is based on misinformation and disinformation, which each side interprets its own way. Very much of a danger. And Europe, of course, is riddled with misinformation and disinformation, which, by the way, their media contribute to as well. It's not just Russian disinformation or misinformation. The media of European countries has always been more polemical than America's media have been, always more biased, more political or ideological. We have finally reached parity. We are now Europe in that respect.
Thanks so much for your great presentation. I did not hear you mention anything about the neoliberal agenda, which for the past 40 years has sought to encase or separate economic management and economic development issues, separated away from any kind of political control. You know, like Maggie Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, and so on, started doing that basically in the early 1980s, and that has continued. So it seems to me that a key feature of de-democratization has been the removal of the ability to guide the development of economies, to remove it from the any kind of control by directly elected political officials. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, where's Peter? So we have till 5 o'clock at least? Okay. Boy, that's a loaded question. We started off by hearing how democracy has to enter other areas of life other than the political. This is a debate, in fact, in Europe, has been a debate for quite a long time. Europe leaning much more socialist than the United States. How has it worked out? There are some real issues that proposition has engendered in Europe, and a lot of the countries are having issues with that. We can talk about what freedom means. Is it part of democracy? Absolutely. Yes? Can we agree on that?
Yes.
Yeah. If you have politicians infringing on a capitalist system, is any of that freedom lost, both on the societal and individual level? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So. I mean, this is going to continue to be an issue in the U.S. as well as in Europe. You know, what does freedom mean? We all talk about freedom. And when we get down to brass tacks, it turns out that people have different interpretations of what freedom is. Manufacturing consent here, perhaps, to have some sort of agreement. Otherwise, we're going to have the sort of political, ideological partisanship that will never end. I come from a socialist republic, born and raised, okay? So my view is very much affected by that upbringing. by that knowledge that I have growing up in a socialist republic. I got to the United States, and the nature of freedom was defined to me in very simple terms. Do whatever you want to, but don't hurt anybody else. You're free to make choices. Don't hurt anybody else. You're free to pursue your aims, your goals, your ambitions. Don't hurt anybody else. I kind of like that. If you want politics to enter personal lives in a number of different ways, what you're doing to me, and I'm only speaking about myself, is you're pulling me back a bit to the place that I left, that I was lucky to escape, actually. My life would have been completely different if I look at my friends over there now that are my own age and what they have suffered in the last decades before 1989. I think the human mind is focused wrongly, I think, to achieve some sort of perfection. We're going to have a perfect society on all levels. Any organization of society is made up of people. People are never perfect, therefore there's never going to be perfection. Okay? And if you push the buttons in order to achieve perfection, you will achieve the opposite. And at the very least, you will achieve a world in which different groups of people will be constantly at each other's throats. I wouldn't like that. I like democracy. I like the freedom aspect. Obviously, I have my own definition, given my background. I know that doesn't directly answer your question, but I mean it. I was not just joking. We would have to be here for hours, sort of peeling away the onion until we get to the core and then rebuilding that onion so we all understand what we're talking about and come to some agreement. That's impossible. Right? Peter says we have to leave at 4:30. So.
My impression, probably less substantiated with numbers than your presentation has been, is that one of the areas where EU really has had a lot of traction is in the area of human rights, that it has defined the concept of human rights and brought in the concept of human rights into areas and cultural domains where previously this was not necessarily a criterion, and that regardless of how, not regardless, but a much larger committee shares the sense that there is such a thing as human rights, that there is a Court of European Justice, and that that is an entity to which to appeal when all else fails. I can see that in Brexit has caused, for instance, in Britain, the absence and the gap that this kind of ultimate institution of human rights has created. Is that not one of the unifying forces in EU?
Absolutely. The whole notion of the rule of law encompasses these human rights. But as you have seen, human rights was only important to about 28% of EU voters. It is far more important in East and Central Europe as a voting issue. But I'll say that with a caveat. Their interpretation of human rights may not be the same interpretation that you'll find in Germany or France or Spain or wherever. But it is very important, you're right. The interpretations are different, but the intent is the same. And that is, I may not interpret human rights as you do, but I like the idea of saying yes to it because it may protect me in the end from something or other. It's an interesting psychology behind this support of human rights in East Central Europe.
All right. So given the time, we're going to let that be our last question. But if you have any additional questions, feel free to chat with Peter after. Can we get one more round of applause?
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.